of Christmases Long, Long Ago is my new book, arriving for the 2025 Christmas season. Find out what Christmas was like centuries ago. Sneak preview, it was weird, and spooky, and rowdy, kind of gross sometimes. Find it wherever books are sold, in hardcover from Lions Press, and audiobook from Recorded Books. It's Christmas as you've never seen it before, and it makes a great gift. Hey, it's Brian, back with another pre-season episode for those of us getting an early start on Christmas of 2025. Although, at this point, is it really even all that early? Yes, Thanksgiving is still about 2 weeks away if you're listening in real time, and I hope whatever plans you have for that are coming along, including, I hope, making time for our annual main season kickoff episode on Thanksgiving Day. But early or not is in the eye of the beholder. And besides, we are here now, you and me, and our guest today. Thomas Ruiz Smith is a professor of American literature and culture at the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom. He's also a frequent guest here on Christmas Past and the author of several books on Christmas history and literature. His latest is Searching for Santa Claus, an anthology of the poems, stories, and illustrations that shaped a global icon. It's here in time for the 2025 Christmas season. Now, the story behind Santa Claus has its beginnings in the 4th century with the historical Saint Nicholas, but it's a story that we're not finished telling just yet. With every new year, through books, movies, artwork, and other media, we continue to evolve this iconic figure. But the version we recognize today, the jolly, chubby, grandfatherly fellow in a red suit and a flying sleigh, the majority of that image and legend was forged in the 19th century in poems, short stories, and illustrations appearing in American publications. Professor Smith has compiled the definitive collection of those things in Searching for Santa Claus, and I caught up with him recently to discuss. I'll come back at the end to wrap up. Here's my conversation with Thomas Ruiz Smith. Thomas Ruiz Smith, welcome back to Christmas Past.
Thanks, Brian. It's lovely to be back again.
So your new book is Searching for Santa Claus, and you present it as the definitive collection of 19th century literature that shaped our image of Santa Claus. And I think a lot of people listening might say, hang on a second, our notion of Santa Claus was shaped by a body of 19th century literature. That's certainly news to me. So why don't we start there? Where does this body of literature start?
Yeah, great question. And yes, I guess some people may be surprised about that. But I think what one of the things that I'm trying to show in this collection is the extraordinary way that you can see the Santa Claus that we all know and love take shape on the printed page. And what you can see is a process of author after author kind of picking up the baton and pushing forward our collective understanding of Santa Claus a little bit further. So if we start as close to a beginning as we can find, that's a children's book from 1821 that's called The Children's Friend. So it was designed as a New Year's present, interestingly enough. And that was an illustrated poem which told the story of a visit from old Santa Claus, as he's called in the poem. Santa Claus, spelled S-A-N-T-E-C-L-A-U-S, all one word. But nonetheless, I think this is as close as we can get to the first real appearance in print culture of a familiar Santa who dresses in red, arrives in a sleigh pulled by a reindeer, who enters a family's home while they're sleeping, and who leaves presents in a stocking. So, I mean, that's pretty much, it's all there. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not that reflects something that was already happening in the lives of American children, particularly in New York in 1821, or whether the author of this poem was presenting this as a kind of new thing, mm-hmm. that's difficult for us to really get to the bottom of. But what I think we can say is that once this Santa Claus appears in print, lots more Santa Clauses start to appear in print. And that just really builds over the century to come as he becomes one of the most important characters in American culture.
So you said the magic word, American culture. So I said before, this is 19th century literature. I should have been more specific to say it's 19th century American literature. And why America? Why did this have to happen here?
Well, because Santa Claus is American, I think, I would say that that Santa Claus, as a distinctive character, as a distinctive gift bringer, is very much a creation of America. I mean, yes, in many ways, he has echoes in him of other figures. Obviously, St. Nicholas. There's clearly a connection in the name there, and plenty of other gift bringers that came from the old world as well. But Santa Claus is an American original, in terms of the things that coalesce in this character in the early 19th century, the things that we're all familiar with. That's purely an American creation, and I think what you can see if you as you trace his appearance in print is the way in which American writers really find in him an extraordinary outlet for their creativity, for an urge towards the kind of fantastic, the magical, that we don't necessarily think about often in relation to 19th century American literature, particularly. There's a sense that compared to kind of European literature for children, particularly, American literature from this period is far more concerned with the domestic, the real, everyday life. But with Santa Claus, I think we if we put him back into the mix, we can see him as a truly world historically important fantastical creation. When American writers use him as a way to liberate their imagination, I think, and create what we might think of as the most important, fantasy world that literature's ever seen, really. The familiar aspects of Santa's life at the North Pole, with his workshop, with his elves, with Mrs. Claus, with his reindeer, all of this develops on the page. And I think what we might liken it to is a kind of viral cultural trend that we're used to these days. And I think it perhaps moved a bit more slowly in the 19th century because it's moving through print culture, it's moving through oral culture as well. But you really get the sense that American children, American families were themselves embellishing the myth of Santa as they encountered him in print. And it would pass from, one child to another, one reader to another. And that's true across the Atlantic as well as in America, because there are some wonderful examples of British children in this period describing reading American stories about Santa Claus and then asking their parents to hang up stockings, and this becoming a British tradition as well as an American one, way back in the 1850s. So I think what we can see here is very much a story that that in some senses reshapes our understanding of what American literature looks like in this period. When we start to think about it, the crucial role that Santa plays in its development.
Are there any details that were added to the Santa myth during this period that have since fallen off? And one of the things I'm thinking of is I think Washington Irving had originally described him as being pulled in a sleigh pulled by a horse, a single horse at that. And of course, we've moved away from that. There are earlier depictions of him smoking a pipe, which we tend to no longer see. Are there any other details like that that you came across?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, there are many, many kind of fascinating dead ends, if you like, in the development of the Santa myth. So you talked about Washington Irving. There are a number of depictions of Santa that attempt to kind of position him in relation to a kind of Dutch colonial aesthetic, reaching back into that earlier part of colonial history. So you've got Irving, you've got James Kirk Paulding, quite a few of the first illustrations of Santa. Look very different from the Santa that we know today. Sometimes, clean shaven, not necessarily, bearded and jolly, but looking far more like a kind of colonial figure. So that I think falls out of favor. You have some really intriguing one-offs where Harper's Weekly depicts Santa in a sleigh driven by a turkey at one point in 1858. Which was a bold attempt, I think, to kind of bring together Thanksgiving and Christmas in one easy image, but that didn't really catch on. In the first real depiction of Santa's workshop, which we get in 1851, by a writer called Caroline Butler, It's a fascinating little sketch of his workshop that, in a sense, gives it to us again fully formed. You know, it's very much the kind of workshop setup that we're familiar with. But again, in the illustrations, he looks a bit like a kind of military general. He has a kind of like a zouave's hat on, and he's quite a tyrant as well in that one. You know, he's really like a bit like a factory owner, a Victorian factory owner, driving on his workers to make more and more toys. So that's an intriguing one. Another really intriguing one is J.B. Green's An Adventure of Santa Claus. And in that one, he's a miniature figure. And he's often quite small in the early depictions of Santa as well. He definitely grows in stature over the years. But he bursts out of an oak tree every Christmas Eve, attended by a kind of fairy court, if you like. So yes, he's a figure who really is a space for invention and creation in this period. So there are probably more, far more dead ends and far more kind of surprising visions of Santa Claus in this collection than necessarily figures who we're immediately familiar with, at least up until the 1860s. And I think that's really when a very, very familiar vision of Santa Claus starts to take shape.
One of the points you make in the introduction of the book is that the legend had existed, obviously prior to all of this, but it was, like an oral tradition developed over centuries with a lot of different regional traditions, or, very, very highly specific ideas based on, just different cultures. And then in the 19th century, the explosion of literature does a couple of things to not only accelerate the development of the legend, but also to homogenize it very, very quickly, right? We have an explosion of print media, we have rising literacy rates, we have more people who can afford to buy books and things like that. So over what period of time are we seeing this happening? We say it's 19th century, but was it the whole century, or is it was concentrated more than that?
That's a great question. And I think that's exactly right, that we get this, that print culture really accelerates that process. I think that's exactly the right way to see it. So I think from what you can see, if you're looking at the discussions around Santa Claus in the newspapers and journals, some of which I include in the collection, once you hit 1850, right in the middle of the century, that seems to be the point at which Santa has become a ubiquitous figure. So if we date, so 1821, I think that first print appearance is probably quite a regional peculiarity at that point. I think if you, spoke to plenty of Americans, especially outside of the New York area, they probably wouldn't know what you were talking about if you mentioned Santa Claus. And I think by the time you get to 1850, so 30 years later, I think pretty much all Americans, by all accounts, would have been able to give you a good sense of what Santa Claus meant and what you were meant to do on Christmas Eve if you wanted to receive presents from him. And there's a wonderful account by Susan Fenimore Cooper, who is James Fenimore Cooper's daughter, who we may be familiar from Last of the Mohicans, but she published a book right in the middle of the century called Rural Hours, which was a beautiful kind of diary of nature and life in her particular part of upstate New York. And in that book, she has a wonderful, thoughtful account of what Santa Claus means by mid-century. And what's interesting, of course, is she makes the point, as others do at this point, is that, I mean, where has he come from? How are we all suddenly doing this thing where this guy arrives on Christmas Eve? Because this thing has moved so virally through culture, it's difficult for people, I think, in 1850 to really get a sense of exactly the roots of Santa. Already it's have become obscure as a cultural figure. But because of that, you get the sense that by that point, both north and south in America, Santa Claus has become a familiar visitor. And there's still lots that builds from there in terms of the inner and outer life of Santa Claus that we're familiar with now. But certainly by 1850, it feels like he's become familiar enough for people to start actually trying to create their own potted histories of Santa Claus already, to try and actually think, wow, okay, this thing has some cultural heft at this point. So where has it come from?
I think if you were to ask someone to name a piece of 19th century literature about Santa Claus, 9 out of 10 people would say A Visit from St. Nicholas. I think that's often described as the best known poem in the English language. But in the context that you're describing it, it was just one of many things like it. These things
Yes.
published in newspapers and magazines. And this, arguably wasn't even an original idea. Clement Clark Moore was almost certainly inspired by that poem that appeared in the Children's
Yeah.
Friend because they're so similar. And yet that's the one that endures. And
Yes.
all of these other ones have come and gone. And I wonder why, because they're probably equally influential, not probably, certainly equally influential,
Yeah.
certainly equally delightful in many cases.
Yeah.
Why do some survive and some not?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it quite early on it had staying power. You know, I think it was this it was reprinted quite regularly. So I think it came along at the right moment to become part of the developing domestic Christmas that was taking shape as it emerged. So I think there's something about timing there that it really kind of found its moment. It helped to bring into being the kind of Christmas that was emerging at this point, framed around the domestic, the family, children particularly. And again, it's a very complete picture that Moore gives us of Santa Claus, complete with, you know, the named reindeer, etc. So it's in its detailing, I think it's probably it's you know it, ha it has a very pleasingly complete picture of Santa that really still defines the format. It's more fully rounded, I think, than the 1821 poem in that sense. And also, I think Moore's Santa Claus is a completely benevolent figure, right? He's jolly, he's lovable, he's likable. There's no sense of punishment coming from Clement Clark Moore's Santa. Whereas in the 1821 poem, which you know is more of an antiquarian curiosity, right? No one's reprinting that one. He does still leave birch twigs for naughty children. So there's a bit of a kind of old world meanness still, I think, in that Santa. But yes, and also because as part of the commercialization of Christmas, Clement Clark Moore's poem starts to become a Christmas present because year after year, new illustrated editions are printed. So again, it really builds itself into people's rituals around Christmas and their gift buying around Christmas. And by the time you get into the 1870s, people are again paying tribute to Moore's poem. As you know, already by the 1870s, they're saying, you know, Christmas won't be Chris wouldn't be Christmas without this poem. And interestingly, you know, people saying this was the poem where we first heard about Santa. If it wasn't for this poem, we wouldn't have been familiar with the tradition. So again, I think that shows you the way that print culture was absolutely crucial for spreading our understanding of Santa Claus. Because you have people in the 1870s saying this was it. Before this poem, we really hadn't heard of Santa Claus. After this poem, he was an important fixture on our Christmas calendar and always would be from then on. So I think, you know, even at the time, you get people attesting to its prominence in their own lives and their own celebrations.
Is there any one story or poem that you came across that you feel like, hey, if more people became aware of that, it might add a little something to their Christmas season?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, to be honest with you, there are so many, I think, fascinating portraits of Santa. That probably people aren't familiar with. I think some of the other poems in here are fascinating. I think Ralph Hoyt's The Wonders of Santa Claus from 1857. There's a lot that's really delightful in there. And I think that's what's interesting about that poem is it shows Santa traveling the globe. And I think that's probably one of the first poems to actually think of him as a global figure rather than just a kind of American figure. So that's an interesting one. Another one is George Webster's Santa Claus and His Works, which in the 19th century I think probably was as familiar to young readers as Clement Clark Moore's poem, arguably. And interestingly, it was based on a Thomas Nast illustration. So Thomas Nast being the illustrator for Harper's, political cartoonist, but also the man who was probably most responsible for really nailing down the image of Santa as we know him today. This was in debate in his own lifetime, exactly how much influence he had on Santa's image. And some people were adamant that other people had got there before him, and which is probably true. But I think, you know, Nast's images of Santa had such a circulation that that you can't deny his influence on Santa's spread on a global level. And quite early on in that process, he produced a double page spread in Harper's called Santa Claus and His Works, which showed Santa doing different things around his workshop and around the North Pole. And then to capitalize on that, a poet called George P. Webster wrote a poem kind of expanding on what you can see in that illustration. So I think there's a lot to enjoy in that one too. There are different types of texts that I think are that give us a great sense of what Santa Claus meant then and now. So I think the letters that I've included from young Americans to Santa Claus that were published in children's magazines throughout the 19th century, I think there's a lot, there are some really delightful moments in there. So I think some of the most interesting ones come in the Mrs. Claus section. Again, you can see the kind of leap forward that the world building of Santa takes place. Pretty much right after the Civil War, Mrs. Claus starts to become a more important figure in the Santa Claus world. And there's so many fascinating moments in there where you can see that Mrs. Claus is being used to even in children's literature to make bigger arguments about the role of women in American life and American society after the Civil War. But I think my favorite is Kathryn Lee Bates' "Goody Santa Claus on a Sleigh Ride." I think that's a wonderful poem that I think probably should be as well known as Clement Clark Moore's. Mm. So narrated by Mrs. Claus when she finally convinces Santa to take her along to help deliver presents. I think that one's a real delight. But yeah, there are so many in here. I think that still contain lots of reading pleasure for a contemporary audience.
Yeah, Mrs. Claus is an interesting one. I did an episode about this a couple of years ago where, if I'm not mistaken, the first mention was in this short story of a couple that comes home to surprise their family. And they're in disguise. And the wife just said, "Oh, no, it's not us. We're not Santa Claus and his wife. It's us, your long-lost family." And it was just this offhand remark, almost like maybe out of convenience to describe why Santa Claus would be anywhere with a woman along with him. And from there, people picked up the legend, and she still remains one of the least fully fleshed out characters in that world. Like, what does she do? You know, we've heard alternately that she's the one who maintains the naughty and nice list. She's sort of like the CEO of the toy factory. She, like, we just don't know what she is or does, but that she's there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And also the question of whether or not Mr. and Mrs. Claus have children. Mm-hmm. So there's only one story in here in which they have a son who's called Chris, and so he's called Chris, and he is heir to the Santa Claus role, I guess, if you like, and I think that's something that has obviously been played with a lot in popular culture after that. But interestingly, yes, he's the only sign of Santa that appears in this collection. And I think those details are still in flux, which I think is interesting, that that's what you can see throughout this period, that you know, everything is up for grabs in a sense for writers who want to tangle with the Santa. And I think, you know, that's still probably the case today in contemporary culture, that there's a lot of experimentation that goes on and that still helps to shape our sense of Santa and his world. Even if not all of it
that sticks, that's what I wanted to lead into is, you know, now that you know, television and movies are the dominant media, like, they're the ones that are continuing to shape the legend and accelerate it in their own way. And yet, it's certainly not at the same magnitude that we saw in the 19th century, this rapid world building. Now it's just more of like, you know, does, you know, he has this little elf who's his favorite elf, like little things like that, that they don't really stick, right? It's just sort of like any version of Santa Claus or any movie that you see is going to just have little details that don't seem to follow on. The one that I can think of is, I think recently there's been retellings of Santa Claus as not this one character, but a role that different people have assumed, right? So someone's Santa Claus for a while, then they pass it on to someone else. That's the only thing I've seen that has actually stuck from one story to another. I don't know if you're aware of any other details like that.
I think one thing that became really clear when I was putting together this collection was, and this might be unsurprising on some level, but how crucial the representation of Santa that people encountered in childhood was, and to which it was those representations which remained definitive throughout their lives. And you can actually see that happen in this collection because texts will refer back to previous visions of Santa as the kind of definitive account. And so you can see that kind of intertextuality in here. And you can see that in the way in which people remembered some of these stories 30, 40, 50 years later, that they would talk about them as the reason why their family, hung up stockings and waited for Santa Claus at all. So I think maybe we need to wait for whichever generation is encountering these texts now to spend 40 or 50 years with them and see which ones they return to as the kind of definitive versions of Santa Claus. And the other thing that I think is interestingly familiar in here is how Santa, the context of Santa always changes depending on what's happening in society and culture more broadly. Often representations of Santa these days will feature technology, new technological developments, Santa in a rocket ship, Santa with a computer mainframe that might on one might not go wrong. But again, I've got a whole section in the book about Santa encountering new technology in the 1890s. In one story, he has a telephone installed at the North Pole because telephones are the new thing, and immediately regrets it because children won't stop ringing him up to demand things for Christmas time. I think what you can often see in what we might think are kind of ephemeral contemporary versions of Santa is actually that process still going on of using Santa as a way to think through what's happening in the world around us.
Well, the new book is Searching for Santa Claus. Thomas Roy Smith, thank you so much for coming back to Christmas Past.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure as always.
Do you have a favorite Santa poem or story or such like? It's hard to beat a visit from St. Nicholas, but it's not the only game in town. It was just one of many works like it from that era. And the wonderful thing about digging into Christmas Past is discovering the trove of forgotten treasures just waiting there for you. Check the show notes to this episode for a link to more information about Professor Smith's new book, Searching for Santa Claus. I'll be back before you know it. I've got a few more of these preseason episodes planned as we count down to the main season kickoff of Christmas Past on Thanksgiving Day. I've said this before and I'll do it again here, I'm planning something a little different for the coming season. It is season 10 and I have a new book out. So to celebrate and to keep things fresh and interesting, we're taking things in a slightly different creative direction this Christmas. I'll say more about that when the time is right. But some things won't change, like how I want to share your Christmas memories with the rest of the Christmas Past family. All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Just keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Thank you so much to Thomas Ruiz Smith, and thank you for listening. You can drop me a line anytime. I always love to hear from you, and I do my best to respond to every message I get. Again, I'm at ChristmasPastPodcast@gmail.com, or connect with me on your favorite social media platform. If you don't see me there and you think I should be, reach out and let me know. And hey, if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover this show and grow the Christmas Past family? That's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a rating and review. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks any time of year. Reach out for details. And until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.